Welcome to Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm your host. I'm an interventional cardiologist and I practice cardiology at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. But this podcast initiative is completely separate from my faculty duties at the university. Initiative to bring you information which is valuable to your health, both mental and physical. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Professor Harry Kramer to our show. Harry is a clinical professor of leadership at the Northwestern University of Kellogg School of Management, where he has been named Professor of the Year multiple times across their full-time executive MBA and other international programs. But Harry's journey to the classroom took an extraordinary path through the C-suite. He spent 13 years at Baxter International, rising from Director of Corporate Development to Chairman and CEO of the $12 billion global healthcare company. During his leadership process, he navigated complex challenges in healthcare while maintaining an unwavering commitment to value-based leadership. He is the best-selling author of four leadership books, including From Values to Action, Becoming the Best, and his latest work, Your 168, Finding Purpose and Satisfaction in a Value-Based Life, and then Your Value-Based Legacy. What is more remarkable is that Harry donates all his book proceeds to 1 Acre Fund supporting farmers in Africa. Beyond his academic and writing work, he serves in multiple boards, including Leaders Corporation and Northwestern University Board of Trustees. He's delivered over 1,500 presentations on value-based leadership worldwide, touching countless lives with his philosophy and leadership titles. Today, we deep dive into your 168 philosophy and also value-based living. And please join me in welcoming Professor Harry Kramer.
Great to be with you, Doctor. It was great to be in school with you, and now it's great to do a podcast with you.
Harry, thank you so much for being on the show today with me.
Great to be with you, Doctor.
The first question I would like to ask you is about your story. How did you go from a CEO, multi-billion dollar company, to a professor in an academic institution?
So kind of a funny story, Doctor. When I was in school, I was a math major. And when I came to Kellogg, the way I paid my tuition is I graded all the finance papers for the finance professors because I had been a math major. And the fellow who had been the head of the finance department, who became the dean, was a famous person you may know, Don Jacobs. Yes. And I said, hey, thank you for paying my tuition. I'm out of here. I'm going to Baxter. And he goes, you're not going anywhere. I paid your tuition. And the corporate headquarters is 8 miles away. So for 25 years, he'd call me every 2 weeks and he'd say, I need you on a panel. I need to be a guest speaker. And I made the mistake of saying, if it wasn't for Kellogg, I wouldn't have run a $12 billion company. And he said, I'll never let you forget that. So when I was leaving Baxter a number of years ago, he called me and he said, hey, this is fantastic news. I said, what's that? He said, well, I want you to teach. And he hung up. So I had to come down to Evanston and he thought I was going to do finance. And I said, you got all these brilliant PhDs. I have an MBA. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I owe a lot to the school. What I'd love to do is focus on leadership, value, and ethics. How do you run a global company? How do you develop people? How do you live a life balance? How do you live a value-based life? And he said, that's fine. You start in 2 weeks, you better get a syllabus together. So I've been doing this now for 20 years, believe it or not. The world we're living in now and the lack of value-based leaders, I'm going to be doing this for quite a while. I loved it.
I completely agree. You know, one of the first books which we were given to read as part of our executive MBA curriculum was Your 168. I was like, what is this 168? Where did he even come up with this number? I had no idea what this 168 meant till I started reading the book. And I was like, oh, everybody gets the same 168 hours in a week. Right. But you argue that most of us are living in complete cognitive dissonance and we don't use that 168 hours intentionally. So can you explore or deep dive into that a little bit more, please?
Sure. No, you hit it correctly. So what I realized was everybody's running around so fast. All of your listeners, everybody's got way more things to do than time to do it. So we'll just go faster and faster and faster. And I ask people to ask themselves the question, have we confused activity and productivity? Or are we moving so fast, we don't even know? And what I realized, and you know this, Doctor, everybody always talks about work-life balance. And I always ask people to look at my hands here. If you remember from class, I'm going to say this out loud and look at my hands as I say it. work-life balance. It sounds like you're either working or you're living. And many of your listeners, they're working. If that's not living, what is it? And I realized, wait a minute. No, it's not work-life balance. It's life balance. How are you going to balance your life? And what I ended up doing in writing the book, I talked to hundreds of people and just asked them, what does life balance mean to you? And some people would say, doctor, well, I've got three things I'm trying to balance. Others would say 10. There's an amazing normal distribution, if you remember, related to six. Mm-hmm. There's six areas that cover about everything anybody would want to do. Some people don't use them all, but obviously there's sort of like one bucket for your career and continuous education. There's one for your family for some folks, one for your faith for some people, one for your health. That's where you put a little bit of sleep, exercise, right? A bucket for fun, making a difference. And then I call it being a best citizen, but being socially responsible, making a difference in the world while you're living. Mm-hmm. And I think, as you said, everybody's running around so much. Do they really take the time to figure out where they really are spending their time? And what I've realized is that very, very often people are moving so fast, they don't know. And I'm sure, doctor, you've heard this as well from either physicians or business people, anybody. And they'll often say, I get this almost every week. Somebody will say, you know, Harry, I'm having trouble balancing my life. And my observation, it seems to me that an awful lot of people that are having trouble balancing their life haven't been self-reflective to figure out what they're trying to balance. I mean, if you haven't figured out what you're trying to balance and what's important to you, how could you possibly balance it? That's why self-reflection, if you remember, always comes first. And then deciding and figuring out, if you've only got 168 hours, 24 times 7, what are you going to do and what are you not going to do?
So, you know, you talk about self-reflection, and I kind of talk about mindfulness practice as self-reflection. Yeah. It's just mm-hmm. different names to this. But sometimes during self-reflection, your thoughts could be running million miles per hour, like how it is normally. So how does self-reflection look for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think you raise a very good point that you have to be careful how you do it so it doesn't become some endless process that just makes things even more confusing. Mm-hmm. So if you remember, I mentioned the fact that I have two pieces to this. Once a year, I take 3 days to go on a silent retreat, no noise, none of these things, no nothing, and ask myself a series of questions. What are my values? What's my purpose? What matters? What kind, in my case, what kind of a father do I want to be? What's my faith? What's my health? How can I be a better person? And once a year, I will do that for 3 days. And then every day I will do a 15-minute self-examination. Mm-hmm. And I'll send you the questions. You can send them to your listeners. But my nightly self-examination goes like this. What did I say I was going to do today? What did I actually do? What am I proud of? What am I not proud of? How did I lead people? How did I follow people? Mm-hmm. If I lived today again, what would I have done differently? And then the last one is if I have tomorrow, being fully well aware that sooner or later I won't. But if I do have tomorrow, based on what I learned today, how will I operate differently tomorrow on whatever dimension of your life has any significance? It just sort of puts everything in its place. And so that's the first part. However, as you know, we can all fool ourselves. Yeah. So you better have a few people you can bounce this off of for a little bit of a reality check, right? And as my wife, Julie, will often say, Harry, left to your own, you could convince yourself of anything. You want to know what I think. The answer to that better be yes, or I got a real problem, right? And, yes. and you find other people. I mean, if I know you well and I'm working with you, I'm going to ask you, hey, this is what I think is really important. Does that make sense? And hopefully you'll know me well enough to say, well, geez, Harry, that's not consistent with what you're doing. Because as you know, we can all fool ourselves. Yes. Well, you might as well be honest with yourself. Why fool yourself? And so I think that's a very important part of being open and honest to figure out where you really stand and why.
What I'm taking from what you've said is self-reflection is also seeing yourself in the mirror, but it's also seeing how the people who are very close to you see you, and are you still kind of aligned with your one true self?
That's exactly true. Exactly true. Yeah. Because we can all fool ourselves. You might as well be honest with yourself, and you better have people who know you well enough and are open and honest with you to say, well, wait a minute, Harry, there seems to be a disconnect between what you're saying and what you're doing.
I mean, this calls to being vulnerable. And, you know, it's tough to be vulnerable to yourself. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that takes a skill set. And the next is to be vulnerable to a person you might want to impress or you want their respect or something like that. How do you break that barrier?
Well, first of all, you're right. I think you've got to find people that you're close enough to that you can give them advice and they can give you advice. Mm-hmm. I often will say to somebody that I'm close to, hey, let's be open with one. Let's not have like a mutual admiration society where you tell me how great I am and I tell you how great you are. No, let's be open and honest because we really want to get better. And if you believe we're on this earth for a very, very short period of time, and ask yourself during this period of time, how can we make a positive difference in any way we can? And so you need to be willing to be vulnerable, as you said. You need to be willing to say, okay, it's like what I call in that comment in class where I'll talk about true self-confidence. You know, hey, I know I'm pretty good. I know I'm pretty good, but I'm going to get a lot better. I'm going to get a lot better. And it's a process and it isn't a destination. It's a journey. So knowing I'm never going to be perfect and knowing I can get better, in my mind, helps a lot with the whole process.
So self-reflection is the first thing, like to become a better human being, whether a better father, better leader, better friend, better spouse. So I love the fact that you start with the self-reflection. The process starts within you. So what comes after self-reflection?
Well, and when I think about your ability to grow as a person, after you become self-reflective, and it's a process, it's a journey, it's not a destination. I think part of that self-reflection will help you create more balance. Mm-hmm. Because I think very often now, as you and I know, we live in such a polarized world. Everybody has their opinion. And as we talked about, I think it's really important to take the time to understand multiple perspectives. You know, it's sort of like people understand their perspective, but they understand others. And that idea of, I like to use that St. Francis line of, I seek to understand before I'm understood. If I'm talking with you, I want to understand what you think. Even though I disagree, I respect you enough, I want to understand. And by the way, if what you're saying makes more sense than what I thought, as a leader, I have no need to be right. I'm trying to do the right thing. So I want to understand what you think. And by the way, if that makes more sense, we'll do that. And then I move into this whole idea of let's apply that balance to everything in our life. Let's apply that balance to our life balance and taking the time to figure out what are we doing and what are we not doing? And how consistent is that what we said is important to us?
So do you go back? So let's say May 1st, you start your self-reflection journey. Do you ever go back and read what you have written? And does that offer any value to you?
Every time, yeah. And so people always tease me. They'll ask me about my nightly self-examination. They'll say, well, do you do that every night? Well, I do it every night. It's a little bit like brushing your teeth. It's a habit I've had for some years. And then people say, well, do you have to write it down? I don't think you have to write it down. I write a couple notes down in my journal every night. Why? Because if I don't write anything down, am I self-reflecting or am I daydreaming, particularly if I've had a glass of wine or two, doctor,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So it kind of helps me stay grounded. And then when people say, well, wait a minute, but you're writing this down. Well, remember, I go on a 3-day silent retreat once a year. I can't bring these with me, okay? So I've got the time. I got nothing else to do but to read my notes from the previous year, right? Okay. And doctor, the best way to think about it is, no matter what profession your listeners are in, everybody, even as a physician, you have like a strategic plan is where you're thinking about your practice over the next couple of years. And then you operationally, you're wondering day to day, week, how are we doing? And what occurred to me a long time ago is, why wouldn't you do the same thing for yourself? So once a year, I take the time to figure out once a year, mm-hmm. how could I be a better father, a better spouse, a better Christian, a better leader, a better teacher. And then I do my little 15-minute check. Operationally, how am I doing? And what could I do differently? And how could I do better? And I'm never going to get too upset because I know I'll never be perfect. It's a journey. Yeah. I'll try to get better every day I'm on this earth.
You know, I think you hit the nail when you said it is truly a journey and we cannot be perfect all the time. So with my patients and everyone who are, you know, trying to follow a diet or exercise, I'm like, you don't need to be 100% all the time. But out of the 7 days of the week, we have 21 meals. Can you do 19 meals really well? And can you just fudge the other 3 meals? Can you do that for me? Some sort of a give and take and not trying to hold ourselves to impossible standards, but knowing, okay, I am going to give this up today, or I'm not going to be perfect today, and giving right. yourself grace. And I think that's what you are also talking about.
Absolutely.
But I love this 3-day retreat. I'm not sure I'm there yet where I can be super silent for 3 days, but I'll work myself up to it. And I'll give you follow up.
There you go. Well, at least start with 1 day. Okay, start with 1 day. Yeah.
Let me start with 1 hour, Harry, and then I'll build myself up. You know, there's this term you used in class, and you use it in your books also. And you said it thing, and I want to bring that term back into the forefront: true self-confidence.
Yeah.
And when you said that in class, it just kind of, you know, sent me on a little bit of a spin. True self-confidence. What does true self-confidence really mean? Is it like you're confident? I feel I'm a confident person. Is it lack of imposter syndrome? Or is it, I am the best and I'm the best and no one can be better than me? Where does true self-confidence fall on either side of, between the two spectrums?
Yeah, super, super question. So the way I think about it, the reason I always say true self-confident, we've all know people, and as a physician, I'm sure you see them, who can act very self-confident, who have no self-confidence, the macho, do what I told you to do, I've never made a mistake crowd. I know you deal with some of those folks. Yes. No, I'm asking something very different. Do you have true self-confidence? And the way I get students, executives to think about it, doctor, is two great questions that all of your listeners can ask themselves. Number one, have you reached a point in your career where you're comfortable to say, doctor, I don't know. By the way, I'm not complacent. I know a lot of people. How fast do you need an answer? I'll get you an answer. I've got a network. I don't happen to know, but I'll get you. Are you willing to admit you don't know? That's the first question. Second question. Have you reached a point in your life where you're comfortable to say, I was wrong? Forget what I said. What Joe said makes more sense. Let's do that. Are you willing to admit that you were wrong? And what's so fascinating, and this is every discipline I can think of, very often people will say, well, boy, I don't know if I want to tell the doctor I don't know because I'm a little afraid she may not think I'm very good. Well, remember in class where I talk about the model, three words, leadership, influence, relate. Leadership, influence, relate. Well, most people don't relate well to people who know everything. Most people don't relate well to people who never make a mistake. So when I say, doctor, I don't know, but you tell me how fast an answer, I'll get you an answer. You may say, I don't know everything either. You know, I can relate to that. Well, guess what? You can influence and lead. And this whole idea of getting comfortable in your own skin, I know I'm good. I'm not great. I'll never be perfect. It's a journey. It's not a destination. It's always good to talk about what it's not. It's not arrogant. It's not obnoxious. It's not egotistical. It's not being a narcissist. It's, hey, you know what? I'm pretty good. And I may have mentioned in class, and this may help your listeners as well, the fellow who is the chairman of Baxter taught me one time, and I think it's true to all your listeners. He said, any job you're in the rest of your life, doesn't matter the profession, doesn't matter the level, there's only two things you need to know in any job. The first thing you have to know is what are you really, really good at? That's the first thing you have to know. The only other thing you have to know is who knows what you don't know. And at the time, I said, Mr. Graham, I said, that's going to be great. I said, I got about 50 people who know what I don't know. I keep them very close, right? Yes. And as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure some of your listeners, people will say, well, one senior guy said to me, you know, Harry, I know your four books. I know self-reflection. I know balance. But Harry, this true self-confidence, I got a real problem. I said, Ralph, what's that? Well, I've got 800 people working for me. I don't want them to know what I don't know. I hold my cards. I'm not going to. And I'm the one who's got to say, they already know what you don't know. Yes. They're wondering whether you know what you don't know, or is this whole ship going down, right? Yes. So it's this very healthy sense of, you know what? I don't have to know everything, but I know a great group of people. And with that group of people who I'll be vulnerable, I'll admit that I don't know, we can do anything as a team.
I also kind of amazed that in class, you talk about true self-confidence, okay? And then you bring in genuine humility. I just love that you pair self-confidence with humility. Most people think they are like complete opposites, but I kind of think they actually work together. You have to be confident and be humble enough to ask for help and be aware of what you don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, no, you summarized, you did very well in the class. You understand that. And the reason I say that is, you know, doctor, and it happens in business, it happens in law, happens with doctors a lot. You know, I could have enough people telling me how great I am. Harry, you're amazing. Harry, that you could actually start to believe it. Well, guess what? Then it's all over. right? Because who wants to work for people that are egotists, are narcissists, okay, where it's all about them? And I think that ability to realize, to your point, I'm pretty good. I've got true self-confidence. I'm good. But at the same time, every single person matters. And just like I never say confidence without true, I don't say humility without genuine, because as you well know, there's a lot of people out there that'll say, oh, everybody's important, blah, blah, blah. But then you watch what they do and you realize it's a lot of talk. Faking this, you look like an idiot. So either live it and do it, or don't bother talking about it. And it, I think that that ability to realize, you know, if I can surround myself with a great team of people and I can openly and honestly tell them how much I appreciate them and we work together and we care about them, as you well know, they'll do anything for you. And I think that ability to realize every person matters, every single person. And I always say, you never forget where you came from. In business, I say, remember the cube, because most of us start in a cubicle. If you're a famous doctor, I would say, remember what it was like to be a first-year resident.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
So rather than beating up people, it's like, wait a minute. I went through this. I know what people did with me. You know what? I'm going to operate very, very differently. I'm going to respect every single person.
I know all of your work is based on leadership and business and things like that. But I think all of this translates to every interaction we have, like choosing your spouse, being good friends, choosing your friends. And, you know, I don't think it is just focused or it's just, you know, segregated to being a good leader. I think this is more of being a good human being and being a complete human being. And the buckets you talked about, it's also your health. I mean, it comes into everything.
Yeah. Well,
so
no,
now I want us to... Well, now, I would like us to get practical, right? You have those four principles of value-based leadership. I'm going to go ahead and call it value-based life, right? Self-reflection, balanced perspective, true self-confidence, and genuine humility. Let's say we have a listener who has come across this podcast. What should they start with? Which principle should they tackle first?
Yeah. My opinion, remember, I always say no answers, but many opinions. I don't do Q&A. I do Q&O. You know that, question opinion. My opinion, they're all important. I actually think it really starts with self-reflection. Because if I don't slow down enough and I'm racing around like always, you seeing another patient, doing it, and you're constantly racing around, very, very hard to have a balanced perspective because you don't have time to listen to people. Okay. I'm running around. People are asking me questions. I better know the answer. I mean, wait a minute. No, I'm going to be self-reflective enough to actually slow down to figure out what matters and why. Now I can prioritize. Now I can separate the difference between important and urgent. Now I can kind of start to think to myself and not be running around like a chicken with my head cut off. So that then enables me then to start to realize, wait a minute, no, I think the answer is east, but I want to know why doctor thinks it's west. And if west makes more sense, forget about east. I don't have any reason to be right. I'm trying to do the right thing. And then you start to appreciate people. You realize you don't need to know everything. So this whole idea of self-reflection, you could call it meditation. You could call it just taking the time to really think through what matters. It literally, and by the way, it's great you asked because often senior people, there was a the CEO of a health system asked me, well, why do you always start with self-reflection? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, interesting. Let's think about it. If I'm not self-reflective, is it possible for me to know myself? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Second part, if I don't know myself, is it possible for me to lead myself? I don't think so. And the third part, if I can't lead myself, how could I lead and influence other people? Mm-hmm. Right? And as you well know, doctor, this leadership thing has nothing to do with whether people report to you or not. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, at Baxter, it was kind of crazy. I ended up in the job managing 55,000 people in 103 countries because if I had to work with you, I would much prefer I could convince you to do something, not because you reported to me or because you have to do it. It's because I've convinced you. Boy, what Harry's talking about makes total sense. This just makes all the sense in the world, and I want to help Harry get that done.
Yes. So, you know, in your books, you've mentioned your grandfather's influence on your life, walking through Central Park at age seven. Take us to that place. What happened and how did that conversation change your life?
Yeah. Well, you know, he was a history professor. He talked about how, you know, everybody seems to be in this mad race and everybody's racing around. And this whole idea of, Harry, you know, what do you want to do while you're on this earth? He goes, you know, I'm 80 years old, but life's pretty short. And he said, and it was really interesting because he said, Harry, you know, you're 10 years old or whatever I was at the time. You know, I'm 80. I don't really feel much different than when I was 20 or 30, but I'm 80. I mean, life's pretty short. And I think you have to kind of think through, you know, what difference do you want to make? And as we were walking around Central Park and he was showing me all these historical figures and there was so many were fighting and warriors and generals, I said, why are people fighting with one another? And he'll say, Harry, I don't think people realize how short life is and realize how do we find ways to get along? How do we find ways to respect one another? You know, think about all the wars that are going on now.
Absolutely.
You know,
yes.
And he said, when you realize how very short life is, and, you know, we talk about this whole concept of, are you watching the movie? Or are you in the movie?
In the movie.
Are you concerned about things? Hey, what can I do to make a difference? And I that had a big impact on me from the very, very beginning.
You know, it's so interesting when you say this. I was on call 2 weekends ago, and I have a patient who had a heart attack. Okay. So, I mean, this was a big, bad heart attack, the heart attack which can kill you. So, and we are moving really fast. You know, I have to open the blood vessel within 90 minutes, etc. So, and it was a very difficult, slightly complex procedure. The patient was not doing so well. And we opened the blood vessel and we are kind of adding support to unload this heart. I mean, this person is very close to dying, right? But everything is okay. He's doing good, etc. Then I go to tell him, hey, you are good now. You know, we've saved your life. You're going to be in the ICU. You're going to have to be in the hospital for 4 to 5 days because, you know, we have things to get better. And he's like, oh my God, I have so much work to do. Do I really have to be? And I truly, it was like, oh man, do you
not realize? It's like you're alive.
Yes. I mean, this is a big deal. And we take life so much for granted. And we don't realize how close, honestly, death is around us. And I'm not saying live in the fear of death, but can we be more present and, you know, and not be obsessed about, you know, the next day. I completely understand financial responsibilities and I completely understand the burden of, you know, having to make sure you can pay your bills and take care of your family. But sometimes we truly get lost in, we forget the forest. We're too close to the tree and forget the forest, fight over the smallest stuff. Don't make peace when peace is available to us. And, you know, I can see how at a vulnerable age of 10, this statement could have impacted your brain all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I'll send it to you because you remind me. And I included this in a blog post that I did because, you know, I do these blog posts for at harrykramer.org. And I'll send it to you because you remind me of it. I'm going to make a note to do that for you. And I don't know if you've ever seen it. And there was I made note of this, that there was a play in the 1930s, like it was almost 100 years ago. There was a play called Our Town. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's called Our Town. And it was written by a fellow by the name of Thornton Wilder. And you remind me of it because to kind of summarize this, there's a scene in the play where there's all this activity going on, all this activity. And as a young woman, she's like a young girl. And, you know, says, hey, mom, you know, hey, do I look pretty or whatever? And the mother's saying, hey, get dressed, you got to get the school bus, you got to whatever. And anyway, make a long story short, this young girl, she gets a little older, she dies. And the way they do it in the play, she's talking to the stage manager that represents some kind of spiritual figure. And she says to him, oh, I'm dead. I understand that. Could I go back one day? Could I just go back one day? He said, you know, you really don't want to because you now understand things better. No, could I go back? It's kind of emotional. So they let her go back to that one day where it's the scene with her mother in the kitchen, of course. So the mother has to go through exactly the same scene, but she's standing there saying, mom, stop a minute. Just stop a minute. let's just talk to one another. I get kind of emotional, yeah. Right? And then she yells out to the stage manager, who's the only one who can hear her. Okay, take me back. So she walks back to the stage manager. So she's, you know, stage, and she's talked to him, and she says, this famous line, I'll send it to you. She says, does anybody ever realize life while they're living it? And the stage manager says, no, well, saints and poets, but no, not many people. They're too busy running around. And this, to your point, this whole idea of, yeah, we got a lot to do. And you said it perfectly. You know, we got a job. We have kids. They got to go to school. But how do you keep it in perspective so that you realize you never know? So I always try to live life where, you know, hopefully things go, but this could be my last day, right? Yeah. So I try to avoid shoulda, woulda, coulda. If there's people important to you, oh, I should visit my mother or father. Well, either do it or don't talk about it, right? But minimize this shoulda, woulda, coulda stuff, which is just crazy, because you never know how much time you have. And you, as a physician and doing what you do, you got a front row seat to the whole thing.
Absolutely. And it's very, very scary. And it also, you know, that's where my true self-reflection comes. And something like this would happen, I'm like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And I'll come back and I'm like, we're doing nothing. We're just going to hug my daughter a little extra. I would have yelled at my teenage son. I would go back to his room, hug him back again. And you know, it's just very important. We don't realize how quickly this would all go away. I have to ask you this question. You donate all your book proceeds to the 1 Acre Fund. That's not typical for a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company or person or, you know, who was in the C-suite or etc. And it's not typical for most book authors.
Yeah.
What was the thought behind the decision?
Well, if you remember, and I think I even mentioned it in your class, we talk about all the issues in the world, global poverty, digital divide, the environment, health. And we say, well, who's going to deal with all these issues, right? And there's this famous group of people you remember called those guys.
Yes.
No, it's us. We are the men and women, right? And I talk about that in class. And the student that I find remarkable, he took a trip to Kenya. He came back and he said, I can't believe there's 800 million people in the world that aren't eating and they're farmers. I mean, how does a farmer starve? That doesn't even make any sense. And if we could get better seeds, better fertilizer, you know, we could double or triple the crop yield. And so he went over there with a whole team of people. And if you're into numbers, okay, I talk to him fairly often. He and a fellow by the name of Matt Forte, another Kellogg fellow, so they've been at it now, I think it's for 18 years. They've hired 9,000 Africans. They start in Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania. They're starting in Ethiopia. They have, as of a couple of weeks ago, they've doubled or tripled the crop yield on 5.3 million farms that have saved the lives of over 15 million children. They're not coming back. They're into this. And so when my first book came out called From Values to Action, I literally called Andrew Yoon and said, you know what? You guys are the best living example. When I'm not teaching, not on boards, I said once a month, I will do leadership talks for companies, associations, and rather than having a speaker fee, I'll just make a donation of the 1 Acre Fund, buy a bunch of books, all the proceeds from the books. So originally I was going to do one a month, and I think my talk with you today is my 1,683rd talk for the one. You know, if you do at least two a year, that's two a week, that's 100 a year. I've been doing this for like 17 years now. So, And I love it because, one, we raise a lot of money for the 1 Acre Fund. We get to spread good leadership values, the things that you and I are talking about, and it's great for Kellogg. So it's the ultimate win-win. In fact, Dean Jacobs, before he passed away, said to me, he said, Harry, it's like the trifecta. I said, well, no, you know, it's like a fourfecta because you love doing this. You're going to do this another 20 years if you can. So,
you know, this is going to be a two-part question, okay? It's the same question, but for two different people. What would be the advice you would give to a 25-year-old professional who's trying to live intentionally or does not know he or she is living intentionally versus a 55-year-old? Would it be the same advice? Would it be different?
Well, it's a good question. The where you want to get them to is the same place. Mm-hmm. Self-reflective, balanced perspective, true self-genuine. However, with a younger person, I would encourage them to start now. Don't wait. Don't wait. And you're going to say, well, wait a minute, but I've got all this college debt. I have my Kellogg debt. You know, I'll do this later. Well, you know what? How about you get started now, because you've only got 168 hours. And as you know, and I know, it's only going to get more interesting because there's going to be more things to deal with. Maybe children, maybe elderly parents, maybe more responsibility. So I would get people to start this process as early as you possibly can. So it's all about this whole idea of getting started to minimize the chance that you don't make this happen. Now, if somebody's 55 years old and they haven't done it, they probably got a lot of bad habits. They probably already getting into, oh, shoulda, woulda, coulda. You know, boy, I should have spent time with my daughter, but now she's 18 and she went to college and I don't know her. Well, you know, as I tease, I don't say it out loud, but you know, you're surprised that your 18-year-old went to college. Did you not realize when your daughter was 8 years old that 10 years later she'd be 18? 8 plus 10, I'm a math guy, right? Yes. So yes. I'm surprised you're surprised. So trying to get them to say, okay, all right, yes, it would have been helpful, but it didn't. You weren't there. All right, well, let's get started now, because better to get started now than never done it at all. It's probably easier for them because they realize they've made mistakes. And if they're open and honest with themselves, I mean, if you're not open and honest with yourself, what are you doing? That you can get them to realize, wow, okay, I've let 55 years go by, but I'm going to get my act together now. I'm going to find a partner that I can trade ideas with or test myself with, or takes a little bit of time, turn off the noise. You know, people say, I don't have the time. Isn't it interesting? We don't have the time, but people and the average American spend 6 hours a day on social media. Yeah. Really? Seriously? I don't have the time, but I'm watching a lot of television. Really? You know, I like to exercise, but I don't have the time. Every time somebody doesn't have the time, I remind them, you have 168 hours. Okay. Okay. You got the time. What's your priority? What are you going to stop doing? What are you going to do less of? What are you going to make sure that you do? And as you know, you're going to have to make trade-offs because you've only got 168 hours.
Trade-offs are one of the first things we learned in the first week of Kellogg, trade-offs. So, you know, we always say there are two important decisions. One, who is going to be your partner or spouse? Two is, what is the kind of career you're choosing? How does your partner fit into all of this?
Well, my opinion, if you've got the right partner, they are the people that will literally reflect with you. You'll take walks. You'll trade ideas. Hey, how are we doing? What should we be doing different in our relationship? What should we be doing in terms of how we're raising our children, if we have children? How are we putting our career in perspective, that the career is one part of our life rather than, you know, letting your job become your identity? No, your job, your career, that's just one part of your life. You know, yes. When I left Baxter and became a teacher, a lot of, but you were a CEO of a big company. Well, that's just what I happen to be doing for a while. Now I'm doing something else, and I may do something else different again. But this whole idea of having a partner who can actually help you, because as we said earlier, we can all confuse ourselves. We can all, you know, end up believing stuff that isn't true.
Yeah, absolutely. Harry, I think this has been such a fantastic conversation. The four principles of value-based leadership, life, self-reflection, balanced perspective, true self-confidence, and genuine humility. I think it should truly be the foundation. And I think I'm going to start talking about this to my teenagers. Whatever gets into their head, hopefully it sticks. But thank you so much. It has been, you know, it was a pleasure to have you in class. I actually saw you when I came for the Kellogg preview. Your lecture was one of the biggest reasons I chose to come to Kellogg.
Oh,
and to have you in the last few classes was fantastic.
Yeah.
You've been a true, true inspiration for me personally. And I know a lot of my classmates feel the same about you. Well, thank you for everything you've done for us so far.
Well, thank you. And more than happy to always chat with you. For more of the things we talked about in a list of all the questions, as you know, they're all on the website, harrykramer.org. People can always send me a note if they have additional questions, because I follow everything on that website. So I wish you the very best. Good luck. And remember, you're one of those guys. So good luck.
Yes. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining for another episode of Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran. I think Professor gave us wonderful ways to reboot ourselves, our brain, our minds, our relationships, our health. Mull over it, let it marinate, and self-reflect on it. And I will see you all next week. Thank you so much for listening. If you found us valuable, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcast app. And also, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as that helps others find the podcast too. I hope you have a great week ahead.